I've just come to New York and received an award of some sort from the American Newspaper Guild.
That's hardly large capital.
Of course not. But those are the men who are in the newspaper business, and I know they gave me that award because of the brass check, and a great many of the men who are now editors or who are experienced in the newspaper game got their education from that book. And in that book, in the last chapter, I called on the newspaper men to form a union so that they could defend themselves against the kind of practices that I had told of in the book.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, it was the Page One Award, was it not, of the American Newspaper Guild?
That's it. They didn't call it a union. They called it a guild, which is a much more dignified title.
What I'm driving at here is that as I look at these fields, it seems to me that in some of them, if one were writing these books today, you would probably say that this kind of ruthless control by big capital has virtually disappeared, and in some you'd wonder. For example, the universities are obviously much freer than
very
they were in that day.
Very much.
There are people who would question how free the newspapers are at the present time.
Mercy, don't take me for a moment as saying they're free or that they are perfect. What I'm saying is that they are better than they were in the days of the brass check.
And you'd go down the line on that, any of these fields. They're all
well,
better.
I wouldn't. That's all a relative matter. I mean, some newspapers are much worse than others. Back in those old newspaper days, when I went out to Colorado during the Colorado coal strike, I've forgotten the year, and I won't stop to try to remember it, but I called up the Denver Post, published some perfectly fantastic falsehoods about me, made up out of the whole cloth. And I called up one of the proprietors and protested, and he cursed me, and he said, we say what we, well, I won't repeat his language, but just we are going to say what we please about you, and we don't care a blankety blank blank what you think about us or what you say about us. And that's the way they talk.
Of course, that's not unknown in the 1960s, too, as you
well,
would readily
agree. I don't know, maybe so, but I doubt if it says.
I was struck by the fact that you muckraked, to use the word of that day, almost every American field of activity before you got done, except America's treatments of its minorities.
Of its what?
Its minority people.
Yes.
Is this a comment on the fact that in the reform movements of the pre-World War I period and of the 1920s, that concern with the minorities was not a major question, that the people's minds were on the rights of labor, let us say, the rights of the consumer, etc., but not on the minorities?
Well, the reason for that is that I never thought about minorities as being any special class. I thought they were, to a great extent, the dispossessed or unpossessed classes, and they were part of the American people, and they were victims of all these different kinds of class dominance. And if you got honest newspapers, and if you got honest education, and if you got honest socially minded churches, all the people, rich and poor, would share in the benefits.
Well, of course, this fits what Raymond Moley, one of the FDR brain trusters, was talking about the New Deal's attitude toward the Negro, let us say. And he said there wasn't any particular New Deal attitude toward the Negro. The New Deal was interested in poor people, and the Negroes were, for the most part, part of the poor people. And I take it this, in a sense, is what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Well, so that there has been a radical shift, if you will, in the reformer's focus since World War II, or perhaps since the late 1930s. He has pulled the minorities out for special consideration and concern, so to speak.
The reason is because they have got the benefit of the increase in Social Security and in education and in all the intellectual demands. and they are more, they're waking up. And they are,
they have risen far enough to be given this concern, you would say.
Exactly, but I never have dealt with foreigners as foreigners or with Negroes as Negroes. When we have social justice in the economic field, all these other things will come. The people will have time to think and to read and to get education.
Mr. Sinclair, there's one minority, though, where, you know, when people speak of American minorities, they talk about Negroes, Catholics, and Jews, and so forth. And I was struck by some passages in the Prophets of Religion where, to state it as fairly as I can, it seems to me that you were saying, now, the Prophets of Religion was first published back in 1918, that you felt that the Catholic Church in America, more than the Protestant or Jewish, was a creature of what you called big capital. Am I reading this correctly? For example, take this sentence. Everywhere throughout America today, the ultimate source of all power is economic exploitation. To all other powers, it speaks in these words, help us and you will thrive, oppose us and you will be destroyed. It has spoken to the Catholic Church for 1,600 years, the friend and servant of every ruling class, and the Church has hastened to fit itself into the situation, continuing its pastoral role as shepherd to the wage slave vote. Now, am I interpreting this correctly in your view of it as of 1918?
I think that there has been a great social awakening in the Catholic Church since those words were written, and I wouldn't, and what I wrote in 1918, I wouldn't say now. There is a quite a liberal Catholic movement in France, for example, you might almost call, I'm searching for the word, a proletarian movement. There are large groups of Catholic people who go down and have gone down into the slums and carried on social work in the same way that our social service people in this country have done.
But speaking again in these broad terms of what may have happened within the American reform movement, it's my impression that if you go back to the pre-World War I period and the 1920s, that a number of American reformers like yourself, socialist and non-socialist, felt that the Catholic Church in America was a great stumbling block in their efforts because it was profoundly conservative, more profoundly conservative than the other two churches. Whereas now we see in America a union of a number of the reform forces with that church, at least to the extent that you, a reformer, are calling Mr. Kennedy a great reform leader, or a good reform leader, whatever you're going to call him. Now, am I on the right track in saying that there has been some shift in the attitude of the American reform
movement? You are certainly on the right track, and as far as I'm concerned, I don't want to sound like a silly boaster, but I hope that what I've been writing all these years has had some effect upon the Catholic laity and the Catholic masses, just as well as among Protestants or Jews or any other social group.
Is there any one social group in America? Let's leave out the world, which is one of your great audiences, probably your greatest audience, isn't it? I mean, there are probably more people have read Upton Sinclair outside the U.S. than inside the U.S.
Well, really, that couldn't be measured. I don't know.
But inside this country, have you noticed over the years any particular social group that has especially read you, supported you, and so forth, in any sense?
No, because I never paid any attention to that. I just took my friends wherever they came. If I get a great deal of fan mail. And I never know whether those people are Methodists or whether they're Catholics. They don't discuss religious questions with me.
Yeah. Well, may I press this for just one more moment? Because I was very struck in looking back over the Lanny Budd novels, which so many of us read. And you have a conversation between Lanny and President FDR, we're now talking about. This is presidential agent. And Lanny Budd is talking about why FDR doesn't give aid to the loyalist government in Spain. Do you recall this passage? And FDR replies in a very interesting phrase. He says that FDR is riding a troika. this phrase here. And the three parts of the Troika, FDR tells Lanny Budd, are one, his New Deal group, backed by organized labor and the intellectuals. The second, it's kind of mulish, FDR says. That's his bloc of southern states. And then my third horse, the third horse in the Troika, according to FDR, is a nervous and skittish steed, which I seldom dare to mention by name. And that, says FDR, is my Roman Catholic charger. There are 20 million Catholics in this country, and the great bulk of them think and vote as their church advises. This is especially true of those of foreign descent, Irish, Italians, Germans, Poles. They are strong in our great cities, New York and Boston, Chicago and St. Louis and San Francisco, and their vote determines any close election, and so forth and so on. And then Lanny Budd says, well, what they have been told is Franco propaganda and mostly false. And then FDR says, that may be so, but will they believe it from a Protestant? I must have their support for my domestic program, so there I am. Now, of course, this is a novel. This is you writing a novel, and Lanny Budd is a fictitious figure. But were you writing at this stage, saying to us, your readers, that this was your view of what was happening in American politics at that time?
I think it was my statement of the political situation that faced Roosevelt. I never had that talk with him, but I might tell you that that's volume 5, I believe.
Yes. Presidential agent.
I just finished volume 4 and sent it off to the printer or to the publisher when Cornelius Vanderbilt came along, Cornelius Vanderbilt Jr. I'd known him for, 20 years, I guess. And when he comes out to Southern California, he always came to see us. And he showed up one afternoon, and he sat outside my home in the shade, and we had a long, long talk in which he told me all about being a presidential agent, and how Roosevelt had got him during the war to get him information in Europe, which he was in position to do because he knew all the wealthy people and the governing classes over there. And he had ridden around, he'd met Goering, he'd met Hitler, he had ridden around with Mussolini, and Mussolini had driven the car himself at terrific speed through a village and struck a child and killed it and driven on without stopping. And when Neil had come back to America and told the story, Mussolini had said that Neil was a liar. Well, Neil told me that he was a presidential agent, and he told me how he went into the White House by a secret door, and what how Franklin talked, and what he wore, what he had on, the old dress, the old wrapper or something other that he wore in bed, and what he had on his bed, and every little detail about the place.
Cornelius sounds an awful lot like Lanny Budd.
Well, exactly. And I said, Neil, will you let me use all that? Well, he said, what do you suppose I'm telling it to you for? So I called my next book Presidential Agent, and Lanny became a presidential agent. And all those things in there that I described as Roosevelt's ideas and his ways were the result of the talks that I had with Neil and with several other persons who knew Roosevelt.
So this is more than fiction.
Huh?
This is more than fiction.
Oh, of course it's more than fiction. It's exact domestic history of the White House.
There is too much to your life, Mr. Sinclair. We only have 15 minutes left. We've got to hurry on to the 1930s and the epic campaign out there in California. I was looking again at some of the pamphlets you wrote about that. That was really a violent campaign. And as a historian, what I'd like to know is what really lost it for you, in your opinion?
What really lost it for me? Money. Big money. They put up millions and millions and millions of dollars. And among the people who put up the money and used the money was Louis B. Mayer at the radio. He commanded the whole radio industry at that time. And they made a whole series of cartoons in which the movie actors were made up as bums. And they were taken out and put on freight cars and photographed coming into Los Angeles to live on Epic when I was elected governor of California.
Well, now, money in what sense are you saying, Mr. Sinclair? You mean the purchase of propaganda and so forth. You don't mean direct graft, direct corruption, or you
God
don't...
God knows how much corruption there was. I wasn't around to see. I don't know whether people were paid to vote or not, but I know that the whole propaganda power of that state, newspapers and motion pictures, was devoted to making me odious to the people of California. They hired a concern, I don't remember the name of the concern, except that there was Baxter in it, and either the Baxter woman or the Baxter man wrote a book about it afterwards in which they said that to some slight degree they were ashamed of what they did. What they did was to take passages from, for example, a sensitive book like The Prophets of Religion, and take a sentence and cut out half of it and make it mean exactly the opposite of what it said. And they spread that all over the state. Anywhere as you went, there were billboards on the highways with these quotations of what Upton Sinclair had said in despising Jesus Christ or God or whatever it might be.
Do you think that sort of thing could be done? Again, I'm getting to a comparison over the span of your life. Now, could you get away with it in California now?
I doubt it, but how can I know? We don't have the same emergency there. When I started out on that campaign, I remember the first public meeting I spoke to was up in the valley in San Luis Obispo. And there was a great big hall there, and it was full of people. And after I'd spoken, the men crowded around me, and they said, Mr. Sinclair, in God's name, what can we do? We have no food to give our families. And I stood there with those men, and what could I say? Vote for Epic next November, but what were they going to do in the meantime? That was the condition in California. And that couldn't happen again today because we have public relief. And they had it as a direct result of Epic. And I could tell you of bill after bill, measure after measure, that was adopted because they were scared out of their wits. And I'll tell you what would have happened if I'd been elected governor of California.
I was about to ask you, sir.
All right. A week or so after that, I met a young lady of very good reputation, a lady in the good sense of the word. She told me that she was a high school girl or in a college, I forget which, and she'd been invited by a classmate to have dinner in the classmate's home. And during the dinner, or at the beginning of the dinner, the father of the family had told what he thought about me, had denounced me. And the guest said, well, I'm surprised because I heard him speak and I thought he sounded quite reasonable. And the man said, get up and get out of this house. Nobody can talk like that in my home. And he drove her out of his house without her dinner. And I'll tell you another story. I knew, my wife and I both knew a young lady who came to us very well introduced, and she told us that she knew a businessman who had made his will and disposed of all his affairs and told his family what he was going to do, and he had got a gun and loaded it. And he found out the radio station at which I was going to get the returns announced on election night. And he went to that radio station with the gun in his pocket. And if I had been elected, he was going to shoot me.
With that kind of violent opposition, and I suppose you had won the primary and the election, do you feel that through the democratic system of California, small d democratic, you could have brought about as fundamental a social change as you were actually advocating?
I couldn't have brought about it all, of course, but if I had the public opinion behind me, mind you, I got well over 900,000 votes, and if I'd had those, and I'd have had to have 1.25 million to be elected, and if I'd had all those people behind me, I could have forced, the newspapers would have been obliged to print what I proposed, and I would have brought these proposals before the people, and I would have campaigned for them, and we would have put those measures through. And as a matter of fact, oh, poor old Republican marry him, when he got elected, the first thing he did was to say he was going to bring EPIC about. Of course, he didn't do it.
Didn't quite do it, no.
He couldn't do it.
Mr. Sinclair, you said a very interesting thing in your Herald Tribune interview. You said that you felt that there was a new kind of social consciousness arising in America. The reporters were asking you, are we an apathetic people and so forth, the usual question. You said there was a new one in America. We're growing toward the end of this hour. What is the social consciousness of America today as you see it against this long background of experience in this field?
Well, I'll tell you my experience that will show you what I mean in action.
Yeah.
I wrote a book called The Goose Step, in which I told about the oppression in American colleges, the oppression of a new thought and of progressive thinking. And one of the reactionary places which I scalded was the University of Southern California. I was invited by the head of the School of Library at that university to come there and talk to the students. And I asked what I should talk about, and I was told that I was to talk about anything I wanted to tell those students about what I thought was important for America. And when I went there, I found that hall packed so that if the fire department had known about it, they would have stopped the meeting. You couldn't move in the aisles. You couldn't get up onto the stage. There's a gallery upside, and I won't say people were hanging from the railing of the gallery, but they were hanging over it. And the place was just packed to the doors, and I was told afterwards that 1,000 had been turned away because there wasn't room.
Well, now, do you mean by this anecdote that you feel that the social consciousness, or whatever you call it, of this nation has continued at a fairly steady clip all the way through your lifetime from the 1900s on to now? Or are you citing it as an example that, just there, that there happens to be some of it around?
I just am showing you what a couple of thousand college students think about the things I had to tell. And I told the same stories that I've told here. And I never in my life got such an ovation when I got through. They stood up and shouted and clapped their hands.
Those students
were thinking about America. And they were finding out what is important in America and what is needed in America. And you won't be able to fool them. I don't mean you personally.
Yeah.
Nobody
but
will fool
you're extraordinarily, if I may say so, optimistic about the picture compared to most social commentators who feel that there has been a marked decline in American social consciousness from the 1930s period or from the period before World War I. And they go on to comment, and I'd be interested in what you have to say about this, that even the American reformer of today, or liberal of today, whatever you want, has changed fundamentally in nature. That is, here your record is that of a very emotional reformer, a man who, as you said, in the jungle, shoots at the heart of the country and not simply its head. But I notice now you praising President Kennedy, who was perhaps a symbol of American liberalism today. Don't you think he's fundamentally different from your generation?
Well, I think in the first place, he's a very interesting symptom of what has happened in the Catholic Church. He's a Catholic, and he remains a devout Catholic, and still he wants a great part of the social measures that I want. He knows he can't get them all at once, and he's a practical man. He's getting what he can. But his writings and his speeches show that he wants at least a very considerable part, a greater share of social justice in this country.
But let's take the part of him which is the liberal as opposed to whatever part of him may be the Catholic. This definition of his, of in which he, you know these definitions, these quotations from him, in which he brushes away any ideological response to a situation. I don't have any automatic commitments. I simply follow the rule of reason and so forth. You know the kind of talk he does. Now, wouldn't you say that this is something fundamentally different in American liberalism from what you men have represented?
No, I think so. I would say, endorse both of those sentences. I am guided by what I think is immediately needed. I don't expect to see these social changes, all of them. I didn't ever imagine I'd see them all in my lifetime. I've seen as many as, when I was very young, of course, I was more ambitious, but as I grew older and came to understand America, I knew that it was going to take time to get these things. I think we'd get them a whole lot quicker if it wasn't that the Russians had set us back by terrifying people by the cruelties and the despotisms that they have. And that has, the Reds bring reaction, yeah, is a phrase that I heard a long time ago.
And you've been saying it for a long time, actually,
yes,
in your
course,
books.
Yes, of course.
I got the one-minute signal, Mr. Sinclair. Does this optimism of yours about a domestic America extend to a feeling that we can pull through this foreign situation? Does it extend that far?
God knows. I don't know what's going to happen about the foreign situation. If we have atomic bombs turned loose, then, of course, everything's over.
Well, by pulling through, I mean avoiding it some way or another.
I hope that we will avoid it, and I pray that we can. And certainly we have to stand by our principles. But I just hope that Khrushchev isn't entirely insane. And if he dies, I hope that whoever comes in will not be any worse than he is.
Thank you for being here and talking with us, Mr. Upton Sinclair.